Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at KSFR. And this show is podcasting on the internet at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of day thanks to the wonderful Dot Foil Computer Services of Santa Fe. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Bill Burke White, our foreign correspondent. Right now, by telephone, I would like to welcome author Sarah Voorhees. She is a nationally syndicated film critic and author of the novel The Lumiere Affair, and she will be at Garcia Street Books this Friday, the 11th of May, at 5 o'clock for a reading and book signing. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. I thoroughly enjoyed this novel, and I wondered, after, you know, 25 years, well, more, I mean, a lifetime of watching films and many years of writing about films, this is your first novel. Why did you choose to write a novel and not a screenplay?
Oh, well, that's a good idea. A good question. Probably the reason was that I know how many screenplays are out there. Everybody wants to write a screenplay, and everyone is good at it, as far as I've been able to determine. And I had a story that I wanted to tell that I thought was more personal than something that I would ever be able to do in a screenplay.
Now, this is a mystery with no murder, and in fact, we don't even know that there is a mystery or what it is for a while. Without giving too much away, set up the story for us.
Okay. It is about a young American movie journalist whose life has sort of fallen apart. She has no job, no real friends. She's about to lose her house, and she accepts a freelance job to cover the Cannes Film Festival. And while she is there, she uncovers some unexpected secrets about her mother, who had died when she was 6 years old and, you know, living in France. And then she begins to put her life back together.
Now, the Cannes Film Festival is itself really a character in the story. The heroine, Natalie, goes there only reluctantly. And I wonder, did you go there, you know, every year of your life as a film critic?
I did, but it wasn't reluctant, I'll tell you. I was thrilled to be able to go. Although, once you get there, there are so many people, so many actors, so many interviews, and so many movies, and so little sleep. People are up and working until 3 o'clock in the morning, and then they're up again at about 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning. So it's pretty hectic, and still, at the same time, there you are on the beach and on the French Riviera. You really can't complain too much.
Right, and if you do, nobody's going to listen to you.
That's right.
I've never been there, and from your novel, one gets such a vivid and sort of mixed feeling about the event, you know, this competition for celebrity interviews, but also the many joys of France, and I think you really give yourself away as a Francophile.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. I can't hide that.
What is it that you love about France, and why did you choose to set the novel there?
Well, partly it was Cannes itself, because I love movies so much. But I think primarily I went to school in France when I was in college, and I had some very good French friends who introduced me to the marvels of France other than Paris. And I have carried it, you know, the way you do about something from your youth, your early childhood or your youth, you carry around this sort of romantic view of it. And when I had the opportunity to go there for work, to go to the festival 3 or 4 times, it all came together, and I realized I wanted to write about that because it's such a moment of romance in my own life.
There's a quotation in the book, The Lumiere Affair, from Joseph Campbell, the heroine in one of her writings that she's sending back to her newspaper, writes, "We idolize movie actors because they exist in many places at the same time, which is a condition of a god." And I found that so interesting and wondered what it was like for you, having spent so many years interviewing these celebrities and actors. You must come to not idolize them, I would think.
Well, I think that's probably true, because when you sit across the the room or sit knee to knee with somebody and talk to them even for 5 or 6 minutes, it's hard to maintain that illusion because really we're all sort of stumbling trying to do the work that we're hired to do, you know. But I think that the true character of even movie actors comes through in a short period of time. You can really tell that Meryl Streep has something that other people don't, and I never lost my sort of hero worship of actors like her and Robert Redford and Edward Norton and some of those really, really bright actors.
When you say 5 or 6 minutes, is that really what you usually get when you're interviewing an actor?
Oh, listen, that's a generous estimate. When I started out interviewing movie stars about 27 years ago, we had 10 or 15 minutes. We would sit and really have a conversation and talk about things other than the movie at hand. But now, I just did an interview a couple weeks ago with Halle Berry for the movie Perfect Stranger, and it was a 2.5-minute interview.
Good heavens.
And it's because we are living in such a celebrity-saturated society. Everybody wants a soundbite from a movie star. And, of course, it's so hard to be on that side of the equation and try to give people 15-second soundbites, you know. But they're pretty good at it. Halle Berry's excellent at it.
Do their publicists actually schedule 2-minute slots?
Well, you know, a movie junket, I don't know if you're familiar with a movie junket, but it is a day of in which a movie star is sitting in a room, in a chair, and the journalists are brought in one after the other. And it used to be, as I said, there weren't as many journalists as there are now. Now there are so many that sometimes they have to talk to 70 people in a day. That's a lot of people to try to be completely new and interesting with.
I mean, especially if they're probably asking a lot of the same questions, they are repeating themselves over and over again.
Absolutely, absolutely, and you really feel lucky if you ask them something that they are able to answer it with a new idea. It's pretty rare.
It's interesting too because in your novel is such a nice combination of actual movie Hollywood people whom we know, like Johnny Depp and Eddie Murphy and so on, and your fictional characters sort of mingling with one another.
Oh, good.
But there's this moment in the book where Natalie, our heroine, says that the quickest way to get an upper hand in an interview is to make the other person feel like an idiot. Is that true? is that a technique you've used?
No, but it's been used on me a lot, I guarantee. Because I think that sometimes there are some actors who, like Tommy Lee Jones, who is very good at making making an interviewer uncomfortable. And that he's sort of the master at it, and a lot of people do it. Now it's hard to know whether they do it on purpose or whether that's just their personalities. But I know that I've seen it happen a couple of times, and it's very disconcerting.
And you mentioned the Tommy Lee Jones thing in the novel, and I thought, well, that was just one of the few. I mean, there wasn't a lot of this, but it was one of the few places where I guess what you might call a little sense of gossip slipped through.
I tried pretty hard not to include much in the way of gossip because gossip comes and goes and people's lives change and you know real gossip depends as do happy endings on where you stop the story.
Well, how do you, as a journalist and a serious journalist, deal with the apparently insatiable need for celebrity gossip?
Well, I never have really particularly gotten into gossip because I have never been in a situation where I can get it firsthand. If you know what I mean, I know there are a lot of people who don't really need to have gossip verified before they'll put it out there. But I also was never in a situation where I could put it. I never had a column, for example, that was all about that. And I believe so strongly that people should have their own personal lives, and we should try as hard as we can to let their art speak for themselves and not get into that whole Anna Nicole Smith thing, that I may have been a little more boring than my readers wanted.
We're talking to Sarah Voorhees, and she is author of the book The Lumiere Affair. What are the most fulfilling aspects of being a film critic, and what are the least in your long experience doing it?
Well, I think I'll start with the least. The least fulfilling are probably that I always ate too much popcorn. I can't think of anything really unfulfilling about being a film critic. The most fulfilling for me is the experience of the movies themselves and being able to see them. For 27 years, I've been watching movies before anybody else gets to see them. So I don't have the disadvantage or the advantage, but I don't have the disadvantage of having to filter my experience of the film through somebody else's eyes because I've not read any reviews of it. And I think that's one of the disadvantages for other people of some film critics, because they reveal so much, or you don't get the opportunity to learn from your experience of the movie about the movie before you hear somebody else's thoughts about it.
I would think that's part of the craft of the movie critic, is learning not to give the film away, but saying enough about it that people get a sense of it.
That's right. I think that's really true, yeah. And I think we've all had the experience of reading a review and then going to the movie and saying, there's nothing here that I didn't already know. Why did I even pay my money to see it? And I think in a way that if you can make a decision about seeing a movie based on your friends and what you've heard about it, and then read some of the reviews that you really whose ideas and perspectives you respect, it enriches the experience of the film without your having to read the reviews before you go, if that makes any sense.
Are you still writing movie? Are you still a movie critic, or have you given it up for novel writing?
No, I'm still appearing on KOB on an emergency basis. I just quit fairly rarely when I see something that I feel that nobody's going to hear about unless we have it on the air. But I'm writing for the KOB website regularly. And I am occasionally doing interviews, but for the most part, I'm sort of easing into being a writer.
Do you cover? Have you in your long career covered independent films as much as Hollywood films in the United States?
Well, I think primarily. Let's see, when was it? When did the Weinsteins first appear? When Miramax first appeared, it was right around the time of Shakespeare in Love, or maybe a little bit earlier than that. Independent films were not so easily accessible. Nobody was really making an effort for people, especially people in the middle of the United States, to see independent films or foreign films. And when Miramax appeared, all of a sudden everything changed, and we got the opportunity. Then they started taking independent films and foreign films to junkets, so more people around the country had the opportunity to see those movies. But it's tough to see a movie in New York that will never come or it will be 2 or 3 years or even 10 months before it comes to Albuquerque to cover an independent film.
Let's go back to the book, The Lumiere Affair. Did you set out to write a mystery, or what was the seed of the idea for this book?
I did want to write a mystery. I am such a mystery fan. I've always loved that kind of plot where you just don't know where you're going and then suddenly you get there. But I'm trying to think whether how the evolution of this of my story of Natty's story happened. I think it it I knew where I was headed. Annie Lamott says that writing a novel is like driving across the country at night. You know where you're going, but you can only write as far as the headlights can illuminate.
Right.
So I knew where I was headed, but I wasn't really sure what had happened to them, to all of the characters. And it every day it was such a thrill for me to go out and write and determine what it was, where it was they were going to get from where they had left off the day before.
So that's interesting. You know basically how it comes out at the beginning, but you have to sort of craft the pathway to get there.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a much better way of saying it. Thank you.
No, it's an interesting way of thinking about it, because of course in a mystery you do have to know that, otherwise it's not going to work.
Yeah. It can't be a surprise. The ending can't be a surprise for the author, I don't think.
Right. I remember when I was a kid, someone in my family used to watch the soap opera All My Children, and there was a murder that had happened in it. And when the murderer was finally revealed, you realized that the scriptwriters had no idea when the murder was committed, who had actually done it.
Did it work?
No, it was completely pathetic. But anyway, what books and authors served as your models?
Good idea to ask that question. I've been more influenced by movies. My experience of writing for me is very visual, and this is a hard question. Who has influenced me? I'm a big fan of writers like P.D. James, who wrote The Children of Men. It was her first non-mystery, I think. When I was growing up, I read all of Agatha Christie, and when I was really little, I read the Nancy Drew. And so I've been a mystery fan forever. So this was kind of the perfect confluence of my love of movies and my love of mysteries.
Well, how do I ask this? When you were writing it, did you feel that there was a cinematic influence also?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't... I should ask writers, some writers about this, but I see the things happening. I see each scene in my mind, and it's almost visual for me, as though I've already experienced it. Maybe that's the way all writers do. You know, I have to spend more time with writers. Ask them that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting, because, of course, one has a very visual sense of it, as one does, I guess, with all good mysteries. You have this sense of, you know, going through the water and onto the boat and what the people look like and so on. But there is this thing that happens, I think, to people who watch a lot of films, that one comes to experience life cinematically in a way that one probably wouldn't if you just hadn't watched so many films.
And
what's that like for you?
Well, you know, I think it's a very good point, because if you watch a lot of movies, it's very hard to disconnect your experience of something with the potential for a screen experience of it, because I know we all had this experience with September 11th, for example. We have seen so many movies in which there were explosions. I remember hearing all over the place, this is just like a movie. This is just like a movie. And this is the exact opposite of the experience, where something has not yet happened, but I can imagine it happening because I've seen so many movies. I don't know whether that's a good thing or not. I think probably we're in a media saturated society where everything is that we see on television seems real to us, but it isn't. You know, we have to figure out a way to learn about, to become literate in the media, so we understand what a director is trying to teach us when he makes a commercial or a television show. What he's teaching us that we may not really understand. And if we have a better grasp of the tools that a director is using, we are better prepared to defend ourselves, I guess. We're not
from the manipulation,
vulnerable.
from the inherent. Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because when I saw September 11th on television that morning, I was so struck by how this wasn't like a movie, because it was real. The difference was staggering to me.
Well, you are a very sophisticated moving image watcher then, because there, I think people who, do you see movies? Do you go to movies?
Oh, yeah, but it wasn't because the visuals were different, it was because I knew it was real, and so the effect was completely different.
Ah, okay, I see what you mean. So you were able to intellectualize and recognize for yourself that this was not, that it wasn't real. I think there were a lot of people who saw it and had the feeling that it seemed like, because it has been imitated so many times. The computer graphics are, I don't mean to trivialize September 11th in any way, but we're so good now at creating things that could or that have never happened before, that I think there were some people who are not quite as sophisticated as you are, who did have the sense of, is this real or is this just a computer graphics?
Well, one wonders on an emotional level, when you see so many fake emotions, especially on television shows, how much that influences the national psyche.
Oh boy, isn't that the truth? it makes you worried for our people.
It does indeed.
It really does. Because we are all so vulnerable to that sort of thing. It's like the Joseph Campbell thing. If something is on that screen and exists in many places at the same time, there's something that is superhuman about it. And it's very hard to extricate yourself from that momentum, the momentum of that the moving image. The power is pretty irresistible.
And the thing that he didn't put in that quote was that when you're in the movie theater, the people are not only everywhere at once, but they're larger than life.
Aren't they? Exactly. They're 20 times bigger than life. Yeah, that makes it even scarier, doesn't it?
Listen, we're just at the bottom of the hour, and unfortunately it's time to go. But what's next for you? Are you going to keep writing novels?
I am indeed. I'm in the middle of one that doesn't have much to do with movies, but I hope sometime I'll be able to finish Natty's story.
Well, we look forward to both of those things, and we want to thank you, Sarah Voorhees, so much for being on the air with us.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it so much.
The book is called The Lumiere Affair by Sarah Voorhees, and she will be at Garcia Street Books this Friday, May 11th at 5 o'clock for a reading and book signing. We're going to hear a commentary now by Ron Bloomberg, and when we come back, we will talk to Bill Burke White, our foreign correspondent. Stay tuned to KSFR.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just a voice in the crowd. We take you now to the office of a prominent publisher in New York City.
So, you're looking for a book deal.
That's right.
How much are you looking for?
$6 million.
$6 million? That's a lot, Mr. Rumsfeld.
You gave George Tenet $4 million, and all he's doing is covering his slam dunk posterior.
Mr. Rummy, do you have a title for your book?
Sure. Stuff Happens.
We'll get back to you. Next.
I want $12 million. Cash. Small bills.
$12 million?
Hey, I'm the vice president.
That is true, Mr. Cheney. What kind of book are you writing?
A self-help book. The Dick Cheney self-help book. How in 10 days or less, you too can be as charming and humble as me.
We'll get back to you. Next.
I'm here to negotiate a fair and equitable deal.
Well, that's more like it. What's the theme of your book?
It's called Condoleezza, the story of a remarkable woman who was national security advisor and the secretary of state and managed to accomplish nothing.
Fascinating.
I have the president on the phone, sir.
What's he looking for?
$50 million.
$50 million? He wants to do a book? He can't even spell nuclear. What kind of book does Bush want to do?
A pop-up book.
That's all, folks.
Talk to you next week, if you have a minute.
I'd like now to welcome by telephone Bill Burke White, our foreign correspondent. He is professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania and joins us about once a month. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be with you again.
It's great to have you, too. Now, we often talk about the Middle East on our segment together, but today we're talking about Europe. Lots going on. France has a new president. Tell us about Nicolas Sarkozy.
So, yes, it's been a busy week in Europe, and Nicolas Sarkozy, of course, was elected president on the 6th, I guess that was Sunday, of May, in a runoff election against Ségolène Royal. And it's an interesting development. Sarkozy is, of course, a conservative, and Ségolène Royal was the socialist candidate. And his election, I think, means some interesting things both for France and for the United States. For France, he is, comes from the conservative world and has proposed some fairly serious economic reforms. The French economy has not done all that well in the past few years, and he has proposed some economic streamlining, which is probably a good thing on the whole. For example, there have been pushes in France to reduce the work week from the 35-hour work week to something less, perhaps 32 hours, in order to decrease unemployment rates. He's opposed that measure and suggested longer work weeks may actually be better. He's also opposed the current legislation in France that basically means if after the age of 18 you get a job, you effectively can't be fired, which while students have liked it, it has actually meant that no one wants to hire anyone in France. So some of his economic policies may actually be a good thing for France. His other big sort of calling card is a law and order calling card, not perhaps too unlike Rudy Giuliani, who's of course running for the Republican nomination in the U.S. And he has called for a sort of crackdown on crime, and in the process has at least raised the prospect of dangerously treading on human rights. He was Minister of the Interior for a while under Jacques Chirac, the outgoing president, and in that capacity did a number of things that were certainly not as bad as the Patriot Act in the United States, but raised some questions. So I think on the domestic side, it's still too early to tell for sure. Economically, it may be a good thing, and in terms of civil rights and civil liberties, it may not. His election may not be a good thing, but we're going to have to wait and see what he actually does after he takes office next week.
Immigration is a major theme in France. What is his position on immigration and the whole question of assimilation?
Well, this is a real problem for France. The problem is basically this. You may remember last summer there were massive riots outside of Paris with cars burning on the streets. France has a very large, largely Muslim immigrant population, many of whom have come from North Africa and former French territories in North Africa. They are largely unemployed or often unemployed and largely disgruntled. And so it is not surprising in some ways that they have been lighting cars on fire on the streets of northern Paris. He has had a somewhat odd set of policies toward immigration. He himself is the son of an immigrant. His father and grandfather before him came from from Hungary. His father then escaped in 1945 from Hungary, made his way and joined the French Foreign Legion. So he himself is the son of an immigrant, and in some ways he's been seen as more pro-immigrants than most conservative politicians in France. He has called for a number of things. He's wanted to limit new immigration and limit that immigration to people who bring skills that the French economy needs. So he's been kind of pro-legalized immigration for people with the right skill sets, but trying to decrease other kinds of immigration. He has actually been quite good on issues of assimilation. He's recognized that in order to solve the law and order problem that he has sort of built his reputation on, you have to do something to assimilate the sort of angry mobs in northern Paris. He has created, for example, a council for Muslim church or Muslim mosques in France in an attempt to sort of bring the religious structures more closely into the sort of mainstream political debate. And he's even called for possibly changing aspects of the French Constitution that deal with separation of church and state, and again in an effort to kind of work with the Muslim communities, particularly outside of Paris. So my guess is what we'll see is some pretty serious attempts at assimilation of existing immigrant groups, but decreasing new immigrants. There's a loophole in French law, for example, that allows students to enroll in French schools and French universities and thereby get residency, and he's called on sort of eliminating those kinds of things to prevent others from coming, but trying to assimilate the groups that are presently there more actively than previous conservative administrations have.
There's always this question in France that comes up with the example of whether or not girls can wear headscarves in their schools, whether there should be multicultural subcultures, or whether people should, within one generation, become French and leave their home culture behind.
Yeah, it's a very big issue in France, and the headscarf issue has come up with both legislation passed in France and then a legal challenge both in France and at the European Court. And France, I think, has had a harder time with this than perhaps other countries in Europe, partly due to the nature of the immigrant mix in France, and partly, I think, because the French Republic has been, a secular republic in such a way that there was little space for religion and religious toleration. And so, of course, the French said, no, you can't wear headscarves in school, and that led to a great deal of anger. My guess is that under Sarkozy, we're likely to see more space for religion rather than less space for religion in French public life as an attempt to try to resolve this tension particularly with the Muslim groups in Paris.
You and I often talk about various other countries and other governments, and one thing we never talk about is how they work. How does the French system work compared to the American three-part government with president, our three branches? What is the French system like?
Well, the French system is actually more similar to ours than many other systems in Europe. The French government is basically a presidential system based on the French Constitution, which came out of the Fifth Republic. The system is basically this. There is a president who is elected, as we saw this week. The president either has to have an absolute majority in the first round of balloting or goes head-to-head with one other candidate in the second round. And so, like our president has a national mandate, or at least theoretically is supposed to. I'm not sure our president does at the moment, but it's supposed to have a national mandate, but then there's the difference arises in that the president doesn't necessarily run the government. The president then chooses a prime minister, and the prime minister runs the day-to-day affairs of the executive branch. The prime minister has to be approved by the legislative branch, and in France, the legislative branch consists of both a National Assembly and a Senate, and there one is directly elected and one is indirectly elected, sort of like the original model of our House and Senate. So the prime minister has to be approved by the legislative branch, but can be dismissed at will by the president. So the president has this kind of legitimacy of a national election, but then can also stand a little bit above politics and let the prime minister engage in the sort of day-to-day fights of government. Legislation can either be proposed by the prime minister or by the legislative branch. It has to be approved, of course, by the legislative branch. And then there's also a judiciary, and the judiciary can review legislation. In fact, it's a little different than here. For example, in the United States, if we wanted to challenge a law passed by Congress, the law has to get passed, and then we could bring a case to, say, a U.S. court and perhaps eventually to the Supreme Court challenging it. In France, the equivalent of the Supreme Court, the Council of State, has to review legislation before it's passed. So judicial review actually happens in advance. But like in the U.S., there's the three branches of government, and they provide some checks and balances. So really the biggest difference is this role of the prime minister that we don't have here.
And judicial review before a law is passed, that's pretty interesting.
It's very interesting, partly because in the U.S., The Supreme Court will only review cases that are ripe for adjudication. That means that somebody actually has to have been harmed by the law before we have a right to challenge it. And in France, the review happens beforehand, at which point it's sometimes harder to review the law because you don't know exactly how it's going to be applied. But laws do get to go through this sort of initial judicial screening process.
Another difference between our system and most of Europe, as I understand it, is that we have a very entrenched two-party system, and most other countries have many parties. Where does France stand?
Well, France has two major parties, but plenty of room for other parties. The major parties, of course, in France are the Conservatives and the Socialists, though there are a number of other parties. If you look back to the first round of balloting in late April in France, there were seven or eight candidates from different parties. And in fact, in the last presidential election 5 years ago, the Socialists, which had been one of the sort of major parties traditionally in France, did not have one of the top two candidates for president, and so didn't get to run in the runoff. And again, you can get elected to the National Assembly or even to the Senate, regardless of what party you're in. So there's much more space for other parties than we have, and certainly in that runoff election, if whichever party you represented happens to win, then you get to be president if you have the majority of votes. Whereas in the United States, it's almost impossible for a third party candidate to become president, in large part because you need a majority of the Electoral College, and if you can't get a majority of the Electoral College, unlike in France, where there's a runoff election, in the United States, if you don't have a majority of the Electoral College, the House of Representatives picks the president, and the House is usually controlled by one of our two main parties. So much more space for alternative views to at least get voice in the governing bodies in France than we have here.
Now let's cross the channel into England. Let's talk about Tony Blair and the recent elections that happened in England, in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, absolutely. So Tony Blair now has been Prime Minister of England for 10 years and a week, and I think it is universally acknowledged in England that it's time for Tony to go. There were elections last week at the local level in England, so those are sort of local councils and city councils. And Labour, which is the party Tony Blair represents, really received a very poor performance. Labour lost a number of seats across the country in three areas particularly. First, the rich areas in the south of England, London and south of there, where the Conservative Tory Party basically took all the Labour seats that were up for grabs. And then also in the two sort of semi-autonomous regions, namely Scotland and Wales. In Scotland, the Scottish National Party won not just the local elections there. They were actually having elections for the Scottish Parliament itself. And Labour, which had controlled the Scottish Parliament, lost to the Scottish Nationalists. The Scottish Nationalists wanted to declare independence from the United Kingdom. They only received had 45 seats in Parliament now, which is not enough to control, and so they will end up in a coalition government, presumably with the Liberal Democrats. That's a third party that's somewhat to the left of Labour on most issues. And also in Wales, the Welsh National Party did extremely well, and so I think you'll start to see more devolved power to Scotland and Wales, and a much greater balancing of the Conservatives and Labour in England itself. What we expect to see happen is that next week, Tony Blair will announce that he is resigning. He will travel to Buckingham Palace and meet with the Queen and deliver a letter of resignation to the Queen, at which point he will continue to serve for about another month. We expect right up until the G8 summit in June, at which point power will presumably transfer to Gordon Brown, who is currently the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the sort of Treasury Secretary in British terms.
I've often wondered whether a kind of oversimplified black and white thinking that sometimes characterizes American politics comes from our having such a clear two-party system and not having the subtlety of thought that comes from having multiple parties. How do you see that in, for example, the United Kingdom? Do people understand the positions of multiple parties?
I think they do, and I think it's actually a good thing in England. England really has traditionally had sort of two major parties, the Tories, the Conservative Party, and Labour, the more liberal party, at least sort of in the post-war era. But we're now starting to see the emergence of other parties like the Liberal Democrats, which now have done very well. One thing I think that happens in England is partly because of the way the government is elected. Right, they have a parliament, and everyone votes for their representatives in parliament. It's a very local process, and I think it's more localized than even our sort of House of Representatives is, and certainly more local than our Senate elections are, which means that people really get to engage with candidates at the local level and have space to look for third-party candidates and others. I was last week at a local meeting of the sort of up and coming Labour candidates for, you know, who might run for leadership 5 or 7 years from now, and it was amazing how locally it was organized and how people were engaged in a way that I rarely see people in the United States engaged in talking to their candidates and looking at a much broader range of views than we have here, in part because for us most seats are locked up. Because of the way the sort of electoral maps are organized, most seats are never in contest, and so there's never really an exchange of views, whereas in England I think there's much more of an exchange of views amongst the various parties, and I think at the end of the day that's probably a good thing for the British electorate.
How does the British parliamentary system actually work?
So the Brits, of course, are a monarchy, and in some ways we borrowed our system of government from them. In other ways, we did everything possible so that our system would not become the British system. You'll remember, of course, the fear of having another king in Washington, and that's partly why our government is federal the way it is and why our president, in some ways, has very limited powers compared to the monarch in the 1700s. Today, the British system's a little bit different than that. There is, of course, the Queen, and she is really the head of government, though doesn't really govern directly. And then there's a Parliament. The Parliament has absolute power in the United Kingdom. Parliament can basically do anything it wants to. There's no written constitution, and Parliament reigns supreme. Though there is a sort of unwritten constitution, the Magna Carta that people talk about, that constrains Parliament, at the end of the day, it could do whatever it wanted to. Elections to Parliament come, at the local level, and then within Parliament, there end up being sort of parties, and those parties then elect a leadership. And if you have a majority in Parliament, whoever is the leader of your party gets to serve as Prime Minister. So Tony Blair has actually never run for Prime Minister, in a sense. When there have been national elections in England, his party has had more seats in Parliament, and therefore he, as leader of the Labour Party, gets to be Prime Minister. Next week, when he resigns, there won't be a national election in the United Kingdom. Instead, the party leadership will appoint the new head of the party, likely again to be Gordon Brown, and then he'll take over as head of the party and hence get to be Prime Minister and move into number 10 Downing Street. So unlike in both France and the United States, there's no nationally elected president. And the judiciary is also different. There's a House of Lords in the United Kingdom, which used to be sort of aristocracy. Now you can get appointed to it, or under the Blair administration, it looked like you could buy yourself a seat. And some of those lords are known as the Law Lords, and they serve kind of as the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom. They get to hear final appeals of cases from the judiciary. And so, again, the system is quite different, and really it's different in the sense of there's a parliament, and whoever is the head of the party with the majority of seats gets to run the government.
You were recently in Europe, and had some comments about how people are dealing with global warming there, and I wondered if you could share them with our listeners.
Yeah, it was quite extraordinary. I came back from Europe 48 hours ago. I was over for about 2 weeks, and the biggest change I had noticed in terms of where European politics has gone is that global warming and environmental issues have now become perhaps the number one issue on most people's minds, which is truly a remarkable transformation from even just 2 or 3 years ago, where global warming was really a fringe issue. Ordinary people in the United Kingdom or in Germany who you talk to are sitting there computing their carbon footprint. By that I mean, how much carbon do you release into the air between, driving your car to work or taking this public transit to work, taking your family holiday on an airplane, or heating your house? And there are websites, and your listeners, I'm sure, could find them, where you can compute your own carbon footprint. And everyone was thinking about what their carbon emissions mean to the world. And that's something we haven't gotten to yet in the United States. Now we do talk about, we should buy a smaller car. But in Europe, people are now thinking about, well, maybe I won't take my summer holiday to the south of France or to Spain because the air flight there might produce more global warming emissions than I'm comfortable with. And that, to me, was a really dramatic change in the European psyche and something that might well be catching on here. And I think can reshape European politics somewhat fundamentally. It has both good sides and bad sides. Obviously, it would be wonderful to stop global warming. The airline industry isn't too happy about people now starting to say, maybe we won't take that $25 cheap fare to the south of Spain because we'll be doing too much damage to the environment. So a really fundamental rethinking of where environmental issues fit in the political landscape and also in people's ordinary daily lives.
Well, how do those two things work together? I mean, this taking of individual responsibility, I would agree, is something that people here think about, but they're not probably actually doing to that extent. How does it play out in terms of people pressuring their politicians?
Now there is a great deal of pressure coming from, just ordinary people in England for the government to pass new legislation. What's become the sort of target of this at the moment is air travel, which apparently amounts to about 2% of global carbon emissions, which is considerable, but not certainly the worst culprit. The government's now looking at an additional £40, that's $80 a head, tax on air travel to reduce air travel and prevent additional carbon emissions. So there's been a lot of pressure for that sort of legislation to get passed. The other place where we've seen this happen in a major way lately is Australia. John Howard was probably the least environmentally friendly prime minister in the world, perhaps after Bush 2 or 3 years ago. Today he has become a major supporter of efforts to stop global warming because people in Australia have watched their climate change so much in the past 2 years that they have demanded that the government act. So I think there's a lot of room for pressure there, and even some of the ways in which the Liberal Democrats, which in England have the sort of strongest anti-pollution position, how well they did in the recent elections, I think is somewhat representative of that change in the UK. So I think this is something we're going to start to see much more of in the United States going forward.
Bill Burke-White, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Always a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you next month.
Bill Burke-White is our foreign correspondent, and he's a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. The KSFR event with Jeremy Scahill, author of the book Blackwater, planned for this Thursday night, has been canceled. In fact, Mr. Scahill's entire tour has been canceled, including our May 10th event at the College of Santa Fe. So if you already have tickets, the Greer Garson box office will contact you soon to refund your tickets, and we apologize for any inconvenience that this has caused our listeners. Well, we are streaming, KSFR is streaming on the web at ksfr.org, and this program is podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can email me at the email address radiocafe@ksfr.org, or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team under the direction of the marvelous Bill Dupuy. And after that, the Jazz Hoedown. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Tomorrow is Animal Day. Yes, we will be talking about dogs and all the other animals, maybe. Hasta mañana. Ciao.